Thanks. I wanted to begin with two anecdotes about things that happened to me recently. In the one case, there was a message on my voicemail. Thank heaven I wasn't there to get it in person. It was Lord knows what undiplomatic, unpeaceful thing I would have said. It was from the Canadian Armed Forces, the public relations officer, who was offering me a pre-established program for International Women's Week, saying, and she heard about women in the armed forces, and her position was that the Canadian forces and the Simone de Beauvoir Institute, which is Concordia's women's studies teaching and research unit, had common goals. So, you know, this was news to me. But the common goals that she was speaking about were equal opportunity for women in all aspects of social life, and women in non-traditional careers. So, you know, again, as far as it goes, this is true. But it was certainly a wake-up call for me. I gently told her that we did have a course on women in peace, which, of course, talks about women in militarism from the point of view that Sri was just talking about it, the way this conference is talking about it, that it's women against militarism, militarism against women, more to the point, but not that we have common goals. And yet, in the short run, for some women, for all of the 20th century and now into the 21st, in the first world, militarism offers opportunities to women. Virginia Woolf says that until you can liberate women from the confines of the way patriarchal society defines our lives, there will be women consciously and unconsciously supporting war and empire. Because the kind of war that she was speaking of was, in fact, openly imperialist war. That some women, that she talks about August 1914, when the upper-class women of England rushed out of their homes to do all sorts of support work for an imperialist war, because it got them out of those homes, precisely. She says there were daughters of the ruling class who went to work in the first aid stations and so forth, accompanied by their maids, their ladies, because that's a lady didn't go out without her maid. But this was something. And by the end of the war, those maids were working in munitions factories, and their employers were driving ambulances, making bandages, doing support work for the war, and calling, as they were at the beginning, attacking the men who were not rushing to join the fighting forces, giving them white feathers and so on. In short, being completely uncritical about what this war was going to do to the bodies of those men and the lives of women elsewhere in the world. Similarly, the first country that drafted women on an equal basis with men was Israel. And one would say, well, that's a good sign. Women in the Israeli army are, in fact, in combat roles and have been from the beginning. They have a three-year draft term to serve, and they do not go back annually for reserve service the way men do. One might assume that this means something about, again, gender equality. Well, when I started being identified as a Jewish opponent of the occupation, I started getting a lot of extremely insulting letters, which talked about my either being or having a stinking cunt, one or the other, this being clearly deeply relevant, or my being a sow, which is interesting. Either I don't know if it's a reference to my weight, or again, my odor, my assumed odor, or whatever. But I also, the more polite letters, the ones that were published in the newspapers and so forth, made sneering references to my conscience, to my tender conscience. And only when I interviewed one of the founders of the Women in Black in Jerusalem on CKUT, in fact, on International Women's Week that year, did I find that Israeli women, unlike men, have the right to claim conscientious objector status. So that the point is that the possession of a conscience is a female attribute, like the stinking cunt, you say. It is the stinking conscience, or the tender conscience in this case. And that also, Ivan Deutsch has published on the machismo of Israeli culture, which defines as feminine or effeminate much of the Jewish tradition, the European Jewish tradition, which valorizes the male, the bookish male, the male as scholar. And this is interesting because the anti-Semites of medieval Europe had a stereotype of Jewish men as effeminate. In fact, some of them call Jewish men effeminate because they, for some reason they don't beat their women. Now they do. And also they thought they were so effeminate that there were some medical documents from medieval Europe that say that Jewish men menstruate. And this is, you know, because they are not, you know, they had 100% literacy at a time when the Gentiles did not, and so on. You know, they were effeminate, they were girl-like. But we have to remember that for every place where participation in the military offers women opportunities, it does not change a macho sense of what military is about. It just offers to share some of that with some women, and at the same time, the victimization goes on. The other anecdote I wanted to tell is about a television debate I had a few months ago with the co-author, a colleague of yours. This is the Concordia McGill thing. We actually, our two programs are sister programs, and we work closely together. But it happens to be a McGill faculty member and a McGill graduate who published a silly book called Spreading Misandry, whose position is that the problems of the world, of contemporary North American culture at any rate, have to do with the fact that the mass media spread hatred of men. So I was given 4.5 minutes of the TV news to debate the author, and it's interesting because we filmed it over and over, which meant that she kept being prepared for my arguments because they were stronger than was expected, and it was supposed to be slanted towards her. So I kept having to come up with new arguments, which meant that some of my best jokes were lost, you know, in the outtakes, of course. But eventually, the one point that I did make is that far from making men villains, the mass media glorify men as killers. And she said, I said, yeah, they show that men are killers, and they say this is a good thing. And she said, what are you talking about? You know, what am I talking about? I said, the best grossing movie every week, practically, is a movie about war. And it is not about women making war. It is not about, it is often, the classic scene is that the woman asserts values about personal life and personal relationships and says, stay with me, our love is more important. And the man says, a man's got to do what a man's got to do, and he's got to do it because he's a man. He's a male, obviously. And that this is inculcated into all of us as the definition of masculinity. That's a man's job. The two latest films that have come out since, you know, about previous wars that have come out since the so-called war on terrorism has been functioning, are precisely like that. It's a job that needs to be done, and we don't question why the job needs to be done and why those people need killing. They are simply, it is a man's job to do it. I'm speaking about the representation of the Somalia War in Black Hawk Down and the representation of the Vietnam War in We Were Soldiers. The fact is that although military service offers opportunities for a very few first world women, militarism as a system takes resources from human needs. takes resources from women. You know, we say women and children as if, you know, they're the same kind of thing, because they have, in a patriarchal system, we're both treated as infantilized, as dependents in the same way. I published an article recently called Women and Children Last in a women's peace newspaper, talking about who were the victims of September 11th in an office building, and then going on to who were going to be the victims meanwhile. Modern warfare kills civilians in large numbers. Civilians are women in disproportionate numbers. Who can flee are able-bodied men. Who stay behind are women, children, the elderly, who are also infantilized, of course, in Western culture, and the disabled men. It creates refugees. 80% of the refugees of the world at the moment are women and children. Rape, which was always a concomitant of warfare, has become a strategy of war, as we saw in Bosnia and as Sri pointed out. And the religious fundamentalism, which is at the moment blazing in so many parts of the world, makes women the target of oppressive systems and of the military as well. And I'm not speaking only about Islamic fundamentalism. After September 11th, within that week, the Reverend Jerry Falwell was on television on the Reverend Titles. I mean, I don't revere these people myself, but that's their title, you know. Right. On Pat Robertson's TV program, and he blamed the September 11th attack on the fact that the United States had turned godless. It was my son who telephoned me from the States to tell me about this before I saw it in print. And I said, wait a second, is he saying that God was on the side of the terrorists? He said, no. And no, there's no good guys in this story. He said, God turned his back on the United States to allow the terrorists to attack because of feminism, gay rights movements, paganism in general, but also the American Civil Liberties Union, the federal courts, which had insisted on the separation of church and state, that is to say, taken God out of civil life, as they put it. And therefore, God having turned his back, it's interesting, this vision of God as having many backs. You know, there's some cultures in which God has many arms or several heads, but I've never seen one before which God has so many backs to turn. You know, but anyway, God turned his back on the United States because of militant feminism. He later retracted this statement, except about the gays, because he said he was making merely a theological statement, not a political statement. And then he was invited to the ceremony of national mourning at the National Cathedral in Washington, where he was photographed several people away from the President of the United States. In short, that kind of argument fits within the political discourse of American society at the same time that they are saying that some other fundamentalists are the ultimate expression of evil. That women, whether they're they're in full burqas in the streets of Kabul or calling out for gender justice in the streets of Washington, are equally the enemy. What I want to raise in our discussions here, therefore, are questions about participation of women in the military, but also questions about, just as Sri wants to talk about the women's absence from the peace process and how that can change, I want to talk about women's absence from the anti-imperialist process. The kinds of ways in which women can and should participate in anti-imperialist movements, and the desirability or not of the separate strategies for peace that women have been enacting in North America, certainly, for the last several decades, elsewhere in the First World as well. The women's peace camps, for instance, the separate women's organizations. is this a strategy to be pursued, and how, in what directions we should take it, and in what ways women, feminists particularly, ought to be participating, or ought we to, in mixed organizations against militarism and war and imperialism. So that's it.